This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitzoso.
The last time we did this intro, 30 seconds ago, Jason accused me of being bland and not having any emotion in the way that I talk. And so now I'm here, bombastic and animated.
I am so excited because I'm going to need that so I don't fall asleep today.
Yeah, Jason is sick, as is custom.
We had a good run.
Like months of no one being sick.
It was the summer. Remember the summer? It was so long ago now.
Those blessed, glorious golden hours. Wasted, gone. Yeah, so we're back. Jason's sick.
Hey, guys.
He had a wonderful week in Utah.
Sure did. It was a lot of fun. Little uneventful, but fun.
I mean, other than the skinwalkers and the big feet. Yeah.
No skinwalkers. Sure. I even said skinwalkers out loud at one point in time asking for it.
I cannot believe you did that.
Nothing.
That is astonishing that you have the guts to do that. I'm proud of you.
I was a little scared.
Were you?
Yeah.
See, and that's the thing is
my heart rate went up a little bit.
Even if you don't believe, there's still that little part that's like,
a little nervous about it.
In any case, well, good. Good, I'm glad. In any case, we're not going to be looking at mythological monsters and folk tales and stuff, which kind of what we've been doing the last month or so has been sort of the more sort of stuff. We got a flying ghost ship. It actually didn't fly at all. We didn't address that, why they call it the Flying Dutchman. I don't know, but that's in the past.
It's how it gets reflected.
Oh, that's
and,
true.
And mirrored. It appears
it seems
above
a little bit of
where it actually is.
Okay.
That's why it's a Mirage Superior. It's above its actual
Is there a
spot.
Mirage Inferior?
Yeah, those are like oases in the desert because it's lower than what it actually is because it's reflecting the sky.
If you want to learn more about any of this, you go listen to especially about the last 25 minutes of our Flying Dutchman episode where Jason talks about light. And atmospheric conditions.
Our eyes are weird, dude.
I know. They are. They are.
Light's a weird thing, man. That's all. Anyway.
And tricks of the light so often end up being the primary explanation for what we're going to talk about today. But we have actually an additional component.
Uh-oh.
Now, this is going to sound a little bit silly. But I'm going to tell you, the listeners, and Jason, about...
Dear.
The Cold War. I don't know very much about the Cold War.
Okay, I'm interested.
And I'm going to just get in front of this. Don't correct me. Like, if I say something wrong, you can. You're here. If I say something wrong, I want you to know that the Cold War, the history of the Cold War, is not itself what we're talking about. It is simply the backdrop of this next series of episodes. I'm probably going to mess up here, but unless I say something...
We're not a world history podcast? What?
I know, we should be. Unless
We're
I say
close,
something...
close, actually, now that I think about it.
I used to post the podcast in, like, history groups, and then I stopped because I was like, I feel like I'm not supposed to be
fair.
Here. If I do say something egregiously wrong, something like, I don't know, Stalin was good... Then feel free to go ahead and correct me.
We talk about Stalin today, eh?
No.
Okay.
No. I'm just going to give us that historical backdrop, okay? So the Cold War. It's a very scary, very tense time for everyone. By creating the atomic bomb, the United States had unleashed something that could not be put back in the box. And because of this, a good amount of our listeners spent a fair amount of time learning what to do if a nuclear weapon was detonated in their area. it's really something that we, me and Jason, can't understand. I never went through a nuclear drill. Did you?
No.
No. That those
we were born in the 90s.
Yeah, those were far over by the time. And as I go back and I watch, because like I'm a sucker for like Tom Clancy movies. I love the Jack Ryan movies, The Hunt for Red October, and Clear and Present Danger and all of that, although Clear and Present Danger isn't about the commies. So mainly The Hunt for Red October. Like, and you really get this palpable fear, not only of nuclear apocalypse itself, which is very real, but also of the Russians and the commies. And all of that. It really shapes the psyches of the people who lived through it in a way that we simply can't identify with and understand. Not fully, at least. Now, of course, in the Cold War, the main players were the United States and the Soviet Union. This oppositional force between the two of them, focusing mainly, theoretically, around communism and the containment, you know, the Soviets wanted to push it out, and the United States and our allies wanted to keep it in. But because of the advent of nuclear weapons, it also added this fun little flavor of apocalypse that could be really used to spice up any day in the life of someone living through the Cold War, knowing that theoretically, at any given moment, it's all over. And I asked my friend, who's a history major, his name is Ryan, you know him. We work with him.
I know, Ryan. You're right.
And I asked him if the Cold War was over. He said no. So that's fair. Now, you're probably wondering.
I don't think it'll ever truthfully be over. I think there'll always be
I hope it is.
Well, I think it's greatly diminished.
On Wikipedia, it referred to this era as Cold War II. So there's that.
Well, anytime you have superpowers, we're human. I mean, yeah. We fight each other.
Sure.
That's what we do.
I guess.
Other than that, we also have pissing contests.
Yeah.
To see who's the bigger power. So that's just in our nature.
Yeah.
So I think we'll always have some sort of arms race at some point in time. That being said, I mean, speaking of races, the space race is probably one of the best things that came out of the Cold War for the most part.
Yeah. And that's what I want to focus on. Like I said, we're not here to focus. Well, kind of, yeah. We're not here to focus on the Cold War itself and give you history of that. I mean, there are a lot of great podcasts that do that. Dan Carlin.
We are not one.
We're not one of them. In fact, there's the Eastern Border, who's one of our Dark Myths compatriots, who he lives in Latvia on the eastern border of Russia. Like, he does this great thing of like mixing current events with Cold War history. So that's a fantastic show you should go listen to. That's not what we're here for. What we're here for is to examine, in a series of three episodes, three distinct takeaways from the Cold War and how they interact with the supernatural. The first takeaway that we're going to do today is the global nuclear arms race. The second one is the space race. And the third is the dirty hippie movement. If you are a hippie,
okay.
If you are a hippie, know that I mean that as affectionately as I can.
Like free love stuff, or
sure.
What are you talking? Okay.
Well, just that counterculture and how extraterrestrials specifically factor into each and every one of these different aspects of the Cold War, and have come out of it
with the hippie movement and all that. I mean, it's one extremism creates another extremism.
Sure, sure. And in the middle of it, there are aliens.
Lovely.
I'm not saying that all hippies are influenced by aliens, just like I'm not saying that all nukes are or all space race things are.
On my trip, I had to deal with like normal cable television.
Wow.
And the only thing on History Channel all weekend long was ancient aliens.
Yes, good.
It made me so frustrated.
It's so great.
It made me so frustrated, Sam.
So yeah, again, we're not looking at this from a historical perspective. We're here to talk about the extraterrestrials and just see how they factored into the Cold War itself. Like I said, our first category, what we're going to be talking about here today, is the arms race and the nuclear bomb. When Oppenheimer observed the detonation of the first nuclear weapon on July 16th, 1945, he quoted a piece of Hindu scripture, which has become the refrain of edgelords everywhere. It says, "I have become death, the destroyer of worlds." Now, this line, which is taken from the... Here we go again. This is probably the 15th time I've tried to say it on this podcast. I'm so sorry, everyone. The Bhagavad Gita, or as it's, as I learned, it is more universally referred to as simply the Gita. And that's what we're going to go ahead and say, because I'm really sick of butchering that every single time. Now, this line, which is taken from the Gita, is spoken at the moment that Lord Krishna reveals his eternal and universal form to the warrior prince Arjuna. It was this incomprehensible glory of the being of death, personified in Krishna's form as Vishnu, which is described as follows. If the splendor of thousands of suns were to blaze forth all at once in the sky, even that would not resemble the splendor of that exalted being. And that's what Oppenheimer, that's a lot of heat, that's a lot of light, and that's what Oppenheimer thought of when he saw this bomb go out or go off.
Well, at least he's well read.
Yeah, he is. I mean, he is. Now, we can all agree that nuclear weapons are probably the most terrifying thing to ever come out of this whole humanity thing. The only thing that on that same level for me is like biological and chemical weapons. Those are really scary as well.
Well, I mean, nukes sort of fall into that category with the fallout. The fallout is really the scary part. I mean,
is it?
Yeah, dude.
I think the being incinerated in the flash of an eye is, and killing tens of thousands of people in the blink of an eye is the scariest part.
Oh, no. Those guys had it lucky.
Well, sure, that's true.
You don't feel anything at that point, and you're just gone.
That's
true. If you're in the fallout radius, you're losing your hair, your fingernails are falling off, your skin is falling off your body before you have organ failure.
Mm.
And you won't even know it until about like 15 days in if you're on like the very edge, and then you just die. Horrifically, slowly, painfully.
Terrifyingly, yep.
And the fallout created on that zone just makes it almost impossible to live there for decades. I mean, we still can't go back to Chernobyl, really.
True. It's scary stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, it's terrifying stuff.
It is just
I remember horrible. One time, the episode, the plot of the season of 24 that I was watching was regarding a terrorist who, like, smuggled a dirty bomb into, like, Los Angeles or something like that. And it literally, like, I laid awake at night as, like, a freaking 9-year-old, like, just terrified and so scared. And my mom had to be like, no, it's fine. It's just TV. I'm like, but what if it's not just TV? And she was like, oh, man. Oh, no, my baby's woke. And
Watch out.
It really is, like, I've been listening especially a lot recently to Ono Lit Class, catching back up on them because I've been off it for a few. And they were talking about, like, H.P. Lovecraft and, like, the cosmic horror of Cthulhu and, like, these sorts of elder god beings. And, like, that kind of cosmic horror and dread that a literal monster, like, coming out of a portal of the sky, it's probably the same amount of horror and dread if I knew that a nuke was about to hit my frickin' town. Like, it is the eldritch horror that humanity can create. And yeah, the fallout and like the nuclear radiation and the sloughing off of skin, like, oh my God, I'm having a panic attack right now as we talk about it.
For some reason, I feel like I'd be weirdly calm. Like, yeah, there'd be a split second of panic, but then there's like an acceptance of my fate.
Jason, you have told me so many times that all you want is to live long enough to have your consciousness transferred into a robot.
Yeah.
And you're telling me that if you were to stare death in the face coming towards you at terminal velocity, you would
Do you even know what terminal velocity is?
It's as fast as something can fall. Okay. Thank you.
Anyway,
I disagree with you. I think we'd
so
all be very
scared. Here's the thing. I can actively control certain parts of my life. That nuke is literally taking all the control out of my hands. So I have nothing to worry about anymore.
Death comes for us all, Jason. You have nothing to worry about anyway. You're gonna die one day.
You shut your
mouth. See, this is what I'm talking about. Anyway, so it's the abstract death that you fear. It's not actually the implement. Yeah. So like if a man walked up to you, wow, we're just going to get philosophical.
Go for it.
If a man walks up to you on the sidewalk and puts a gun in your face and says, you're about to die, are you going to have that same calm of there's nothing I can do from here or what?
I'd probably freak out. If it's literally next to my head,
I'd probably freak out.
I'd probably freak out. But if it is literally next to my head, there you can be faster than someone who's trying to pull the trigger at that point in time.
Sure, that's true.
You can knock it out of the way.
Sure. So to you, it just comes down to having to be in a situation where there's nothing, no possible.
Yeah, there's nothing for me to do.
And that is what a nuclear bomb represents.
Exactly.
And that's why it's that eldritch horror and that otherworldly fear is because there's nothing to be done. And you know what? Some people survive the blast, and that's unreal. That's amazing and terrible in its own way, but like it's scary. And thank you for listening to my TED Talk. That's my TED Talk. Nuclear bombs are scary. This fear, this extreme terror of nuclear Armageddon, it would seem, however, was shared by more than just the entire population of planet Earth. It also seems to be the concern of the extra or ultra-terrestrials.
What?
Yep, for reasons that I hope to get into at some point during this or the next two or three episodes. Now, if you are unlike me, and you can remember further back than a day or two, you may even be able to remember back to about 8 years ago. And if you do, you may remember when a story broke, which was largely ignored by the mainstream media, or, as I like to call it, the lamestream media. I don't like to call it that. And this story was picked up mostly as a joke by others, but especially in the world of UFOs and extraterrestrials, if you're somebody who even remotely believes in the existence of extraterrestrials, UFOs in and of itself, it's actually quite a terrifying story and quite a terrifying claim. It is this idea, which was put forward by 6 former members of the military, that there was something that had been directly interfering with America's nuclear arsenal throughout the Cold War. Now, the group that brought these claims to light was, like I said, it was 7 people. It was 6 former Air Force officers and 1 former enlisted man. The frontman of the group was a man who was a former captain. His name was Robert Salas. And every one of the individuals who were part of this group had their own stories of UFO interference. Now, for Robert Salas, his interference took place in Montana on March 16th of 1967 at Malmstrom Air Force Base. According to him, he was on duty in the wee early hours of the morning. I'm going to guess the witching hour.
Dude, it's the witching hour somewhere, man.
It is. We actually got some amazing fan art that I haven't showed you yet. She sent it in. It's by an artist named Jenny Bowler, who works with, do you remember Roots Boise?
Yeah.
We did like that little, yeah. It was so fun.
Yeah.
She works with Roots Boise, and she like made us a little design of like these potions, and it says it's the witching hour somewhere. It's amazing. We'll put them on Facebook and stuff. Thank you for reminding
me. Have you watched The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina yet?
No, I haven't. So, I tried to, and my wife was like, it's going to be scary. And I was like, no, it's about Sabrina the Teenage Witch. She's like, she's a witch. And I was like, no, Katie, no. Because she wasn't allowed to watch Sabrina when she was growing up. So
yeah,
she thinks it's scary, and it's not.
Get that. Was she allowed to like watch Harry Potter or read Harry Potter?
Yeah, thankfully.
Was that more just Harry socially Potter. Acceptable?
Yeah, well, it was just like, oh, Harry Potter has a good overall moral message, whereas like Sabrina the Teenage Witch is just a witch being a terrible teenager, like going through terrible teenager things.
Yeah, but Salem.
That's true. I'm all Salem on board is with all the talking cap. Anyway, so he's on duty. It's the witching hour. And he is stationed underground where 10 Minuteman I missiles, which were armed with nuclear warheads, were being kept. Now, as the name implies, these Minutemen missiles were meant to be launched at any moment and could serve as a primary deterrent to the mutual nuclear war, as they could pretty much get anywhere in the world faster than any other kind of missile. So it was pretty pointless to attack us because we'd hit you first. Maybe you'd hit us, but we'd hit you first.
Eye for an eye, buddy.
Yeah. So with that in mind, it's all the more disconcerting when Salas begins to receive phone calls from the security guards who are stationed on the surface above the silos. Now, the men tell him that there were strange lights in the sky, and he laughs it off and says, yeah, sure, because this was 1967. It's UFO fever. It's UFO heyday. Like, it's happening all over, and especially the Air Force is so directly linked with UFOs in the public consciousness because of Blue Book and stuff like that. He thinks they're just having a joke on him. However, about 10 minutes later, he gets another call that instead of it just being weird lights moving in the sky, there is a glowing red oval-shaped object about 40 feet in diameter hovering above the main gate to the area. Now, according to Salas and substantiated by other individuals that were there at the time, this phone call was immediately followed by security alarms going off. The alarms indicated that the 10 missiles had suddenly been rendered non-operational. Unknown to him at the time, but later confirmed by a former colonel by the name of Maywald, there was an intrusion alarm that went off at a different silo. And the men who had been sent to respond to that had sighted another UFO hovering directly above the silos, and this two-man detail raced back to launch control. One of the men was so badly shaken that he had to be taken to the hospital. And in the aftermath of the encounter, Salas claims that everyone involved was faced with a gag order and threatened with not only dismissal from the armed forces if they disagreed, but a lot worse on top of that. Numerous documents have been released which confirm some sort of event taking place in the sky above Malmstrom, and civilian witnesses in the surrounding area also have stories of seeing UFOs during that same time period. Now, one document talks of a witness, unnamed, who after the event checked the affected missiles and realized that the tracking information of one of them had been remotely changed. This is not something that can really be done. Like, in order to get this missile recalibrated, they had to remove it from the silo and work on it for a number of days before it could get brought back in. And yet, it seemed to have happened in just about a 15 to 30 second window when these missiles were rendered non-operational. And then, as they watched the UFOs...
What kind of technology are we talking about? They're not really digital quite yet, are they?
No, they're not digital.
They're still very analog.
Yeah, I don't know how it works.
So, how would you even be able to do that remotely?
You wouldn't. That's the whole point, is that, okay, like I said, to work on it, to get it back,
they couldn't even pull that bad boy out.
They couldn't even just go within the little silo. They had to take it out of the ground and, like, go work on it.
Man, wouldn't it be crazy to, like, see how it's made or whatever about those silos?
That would be pretty cool.
Those modern wonders or modern marvels.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say about nuclear warheads. And I was like, North Korea wishes.
I don't need to know how to make those.
Yeah, that's
they sound
too much
expensive.
Power. That's true.
But yeah, the silos, I mean, think about that. Like, they're so big.
They are.
And they had to be dug, like, so quickly.
I think, I can't remember what I've seen it on. It was on some movie or some TV show where it shows, like, a cornfield in wherever there's corn, Nebraska. There it is. A cornfield in Nebraska, like...
I think I've seen that same movie.
Yeah, just opening up and a missile coming out. And that's the thing, is, like, the people on the base know that there are nuclear missiles. The people around the town might have an idea, but, like, this is technically highly classified. So, like, there could be nuclear missiles. There are nuclear missiles somewhere in the state. Like,
of course.
And if the time comes to launch them, we may be very surprised as to where they are. It's just a very weird thing to think about.
The football field just opens up.
Yeah, pretty much. So yeah, it's something physically impossible. And according to Salas, he as well, never before or after did that ever happen again, those missiles being suddenly rendered non-operational. all of the warning lights, everything came on all at the same time. However, these stories don't just come from the height of the Cold War. Some of them actually come from before the bomb itself actually existed. Now, they're also not only contained to members of the Air Force, which is, again, the branch most commonly associated with UFOs, but throughout the armed services. And according to a naval lieutenant named Clarence Clem, which is a fantastic name.
It's so original.
It's just a good old, you can trust him. You can trust Clarence Clem.
Sounds like a name Stanley would make up.
That was mean.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
He is a superhero in his own way. Clarence. Yep.
Okay.
And Stanley. Now,
tell me why.
I'm going to tell you why. So he was stationed. He's actually not that impressive, but he was stationed on the USS Cowpens, CVL-25, which was nicknamed the Mighty Moo.
At least we still have our humor.
Right. He and his group were sent to the Naval Air Station Pasco for ground support. This was in Washington State. They were sent there for ground support training, and they also experienced some anomalous activity in January of 1945. See, right across the Columbia River from where they were doing their training was a top-secret ordnance facility called Hanford. Those with an interest will recognize that Hanford was the site of the home of the first ever full-scale plutonium production reactor in the world. It was here that the plutonium was created that would just later that year be used at Trinity to detonate the first atomic bomb and then later in Nagasaki. But a few months before any of that, a report of an unknown object came in, flying in the airspace above Hanford. Now, due to the nature of projects taking place there, the airspace was 100% restricted. Not even military aircraft was normally authorized to fly over the site. And Clem was in the control tower when he gets this report, this message. And he's communicating with the pilots who were sent to investigate the bogey above the ordnance site. Now, as they approached, they described a strange sight. Unlike anything they had ever seen before, they described it as a luminous and brilliant ball of fire, which was hovering above the site. And upon their approach, the ball took off at unthinkable speeds. But even when pushing their planes to the absolute limit, they were unable to gain any ground on it at all. The object sped off to the northwest towards Seattle and was promptly lost by radar. Now, although this is the closest that Clem was to any event, he claims that two other similar events took place as they were stationed at Pasco as well. And this account would later be confirmed by a document that was directed to the commanding general of the Army Air Force, wherein a battery of searchlights were ordered to be relocated to an area where they could be used to spot the objects which had appeared on radar. But no disturbance was ever reported inside the plant at the time. So you get this other, just kind of a weird account. So what could be an explanation for this? I don't think it is, but what could be, did you know about the Japanese incendiary balloons?
No. So those sound cool,
it's
though.
Quite an interesting thing. Basically, the idea is that the Japanese filled these balloons with incendiary devices and floated them all the way across the ocean. And then they were supposed to land on the west.
Yeah. Like the Pacific Ocean.
The ocean, my good man.
That's the big ocean.
The big one. I don't know that they were
launched.
Is it
like a blimp or like a
I don't think
like
so.
Just a normal hot air balloon size where it's just like, okay, go.
Yeah, I think they were even smaller than a hot air balloon.
So like a weather balloon size?
Yes, yeah, weather balloon. But I don't know exactly how the scheme worked. I don't believe that they were sent from Japan itself. I believe that there was planes or something stationed that dropped the balloons. And the reason why I think that is because all of these balloon attacks failed except for one. And it's really quite an interesting story. I can't remember the specifics, but essentially what it is that one of these balloon attacks succeeded. And there was a small Oregon town that was set on fire. Like, I don't think there was a lot I don't think there was any loss of life. There was just a lot of property damage, but they got everything under control. And later, after the war, the Japanese pilot This is one of my favorite humanity stories. The Japanese pilot who had dropped the incendiary devices to be blown over, he went to the town. And he went to the town with his wife and his children, and he went with his family's katana that had been in his family for generations. He had gone to meet the people that he tried to kill, and if they so chose, he was going to commit harikiri. And he was going to ritualistically commit suicide as a recompense for the damage that he did and the pain that he caused to these people. He gets there, and he's like a local hero. It's paradoxical. They meet this guy who tried to set their town on fire, and they're like, oh, we're so glad you're here. Come on. Welcome to the family. You're part of the team now. We're all on the same side together. We love each other. And like, he's like, what the heck? I tried to kill you people. And they're like, nah, man, we don't care. You're fine. You failed anyway. You kind of succeeded, but you mostly failed anyway. And then he like gave them the katana, and they still have it in their town hall. It's amazing. It's like the best story. I will look up the name of this person so you can read more about
it. That's ridiculous.
But it's one of my favorite things that has ever happened on this planet. But those incendiary balloons, that's the biggest explanation for this event, because it's roughly the right time and the right area. It's actually in, like I said, 1945. So during the height of the war.
So why use balloons over just like a parachute system?
I don't know. Probably because we could have shot people down.
Well, we could just shoot a balloon down too.
That's
true. Balloon,
I don't know. I'm not a military strategist.
How do you make it drop correctly? Like, what stops it from just keep floating? You know?
I don't know.
Just keep floating on?
Military engineers figured this out.
Okay.
Here, let me do this really quick here. Okay, so I looked it up really quick because it's such a good story. I want you all to be able to find it if you want. He was a man by the name of Fujita Nobuo. So that's Fujita space Nobuo. And he has this quote in his diary that talks about why he went to the town and why he was prepared to do what he was prepared to do. And he says, quote, "If we knew each other, if we understood each other as a friend, this foolish war would never have happened. I sincerely hope that a day would come where everyone could overcome their differences through talking and not fighting." I love that man. I love him a lot. He was named an honorary citizen. His ashes were scattered at the site where the bomb landed. Like, he's amazing.
He's an Oregonian.
He is an Oregonian through and through. That's so Oregon.
Yeah.
I love him.
That's all I can think of.
Anyway.
Oregon wood.
Anyway. But yeah, it's so back to the at hand. That's one explanation for it. I don't think it's a particularly good explanation because this thing, this fireball, seemed to exhibit powered flight. Like they were pursuing it. It was going faster than a jet could. And that's a pretty good indication that it's not just a balloon.
It's probably a missile
flying about. It could be.
Like, that's what it sounds like the most.
Right. But if it's a missile and it's flying off towards the most populated place in all of Washington, why are there no reports of it either passing over or landing or anything like that?
I don't know, man.
I don't know. But it's interesting because you don't...
Explode in the atmosphere?
Could be. When you get this report, it's not like there was a UFO over Hanford. It's literally a requisition form that, like, has... as an addendum, like, there have been strange objects over the Hanford site, but what we need is a big old thing of lights to look at it. And it's just like the kind of bureaucracy and like clerical work that I really think is going to be what exposes the alien agenda once and for all. Requisition forms and the like.
I think you're being sarcastic.
No, I'm really not.
Really?
I'm really not. I think that when we get like ironclad evidence, it's going to be because like somebody wrote the wrong thing on a menial piece of paperwork that they didn't think anyone would ever see.
That would happen.
It would.
That would.
I'm surprised it hasn't likely. Already. This week, Not Alone is sponsored by HelloFresh. Now, what is HelloFresh? Well, HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just focus on cooking, eating, and enjoying. See, with HelloFresh, there's something for everyone. There's three different plans to choose from. Each box is made up of fresh, responsibly obtained ingredients from carefully selected farms and high-rated trusted sources. And HelloFresh will help you to rediscover the excitement of cooking. You can look forward to your delivery knowing that dinner just got that much easier. You can feel confident when cooking HelloFresh. The recipes are simple and outlined with pictures on step-by-step instructional cards. One thing we always run into is, okay, I think we've got everything. We go to the store, we come back, and we find out we're out of some specific spice or some specific mainstay that we really should have and we didn't even think to check. With HelloFresh, that is never going to happen because they send you everything you need for each and every meal. And cooking with HelloFresh is simple and convenient. It's not a chore. It's not something to be dreaded. You don't have to be afraid of cooking, which is something that I literally am afraid to do, is to cook. I mean, these are all stuff that I want to eat. It's not any of the thing like, okay, well, there's two meals I really want this week and one meal I don't. You've got, like, we got creamy dill chicken. We got one pan orzo Italiano with chicken sausage and tomatoes and a Hall of Fame recipe, as they call it, which is a pork carnitas tacos with pickled onions and Monterey Jack cheese. And it really is. I mean, the one that I enjoyed the most was the pork carnitas because I enjoy tacos a little bit more than I should. And it truly is, like, it's pictures. It's simple, normal words. I get overwhelmed by the idea of sauteing something. And it's just the kind of words and language where even if you've never cooked in your life, I guarantee they make it so simple that you can make restaurant quality food even if you've never done it before. So I really truly recommend this service. And for being a listener of Not Alone, we have a special offer. You can actually get $60 off. That's $20 off each of your first three boxes if you visit HelloFresh.com/alone60 and enter the promo code ALONE60 at checkout. Okay, so you're going to have more time, more money, better food, less stress. I mean, there's really no downside here. So again, you go to HelloFresh.com/alone60 and enter ALONE60 at checkout. Back to the show. Now, it should be noted that these accounts aren't just limited to the continental U.S. Longtime listeners will remember the Rendlesham Forest account, which took place in Bentwaters, near the Bentwaters Royal Air Force Base, which was another nuclear armed base, and there was talk of these UFOs somehow interacting with the missiles there. But yet another account, however, shows that the UFOs aren't just concerned with nuclear weapons hiding underground. In fact, there have been multiple accounts of UFOs interacting with missiles in flight. Now, the warheads in question are always dummies because, of course, there have only ever been two atomic bombs used in war. But when, and some people, I've seen documentaries about this that say that anytime an intercontinental ballistic missile leaves, like, the atmosphere and gets up before coming down, every time it's intercepted by aliens. I don't know about
every
that.
Time?
I don't know about
That's
that because,
a pretty quick response.
Well, it is. But also, I don't know how many times an ICBM has actually been launched.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, who can say? But what we do know is that there's at least one time documented. And what we see is this story that comes from a man by the name of Dr. Robert M. Jacobs. At the time of this story, he's working as a lieutenant. It's September of 1965. He's a lieutenant who is a cameraman for the Air Force. Now, he has the job of going around and filming as much as he can missile launches and missile flights during testing operations. There is another man present during this story by the name of Florenz J. Mansman. He's a real Mansman. And
God, how long have you been waiting to say that?
I literally just thought of it as I said it, so my wit is on point. This Major Mansman is around. He's not necessarily present during this first step. He may or may not be. But what we see is an incident known as the Big Sur incident, which is, of course, in California, where Jason's from. Jason?
California is a big state, man.
I know.
I've never been to big state.
You've never been. Okay, that's what I was going to ask. Because we talked about it with the Dark Watchers. They're also in Big Sur. So
clearly, I have to go back to California.
There's probably some connection between Big Sur, the Dark Watchers, and aliens. Because what we see is Lieutenant Jacobs. He's running the cameras. They get it from six different angles during this missile test. And while the test isn't a success, the missile actually fails. It comes miles away from hitting its target. It comes down. There's nothing weird that happens. This happens.
That's
this is
horrible,
exact,
though. Miles away from your trajectory?
Miles away from
that
target.
That is so bad.
Well, it's a missile test. This is what you got to do.
I mean,
you
got to
test them.
But God, it's like a drunk guy at a urinal.
I don't know about that. but Jacobs talks about, like, that's life. It happens. He's not too concerned.
Yeah,
whatever.
So is the drunk guy.
Now, a week or two later, Jacob recalls being called in to discuss some of his footage from that test. He arrives at Vandenberg Air Force Base and is quickly ushered into an unmarked building. He realizes that there's something a little strange because as he comes in, there's a man there. It's the aforementioned Florenz J. Mansman, who was a major at the time, and he's in full military uniform. But there are also two other men who are dressed in unmarked gray suits who decline to identify themselves. The other military...
What a jerk.
Just, you can't even do him the courtesy.
What is this, the 40s? Come on, I thought people had manners back then.
I know, you would think so. This was the 60s. They didn't have manners.
Ah, you're right. They had scotch.
They had scotch. What? Did we not have scotch?
When I think of the 60s, I think of Mad Men, and they always are drinking something.
That's fair. I've never seen Mad Men.
It's great.
Is it?
Like, it's one of the things that got me, like, really interested in, like, marketing and like how we advertise to people and things like that. I thought it was really interesting to see how like that progress goes.
Wait a second here. Do they say that they're ad men? Is that where this comes from? They're like, ah, we're ad men, but then actually they're mad men?
No.
Okay, cool.
Mad Men is referring to Madison Avenue.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. That makes more sense. Anyway, so the four of them sit down together and they watch this film. Shockingly, and seemingly out of nowhere, an object appears. When the film is examined under a magnifier, it can be seen that this object has... It's obviously not like a dead ringer because it's crappy old film, but like, there seems to be a shape to it. It seems to have a distinct disc-like outline. There seems to be a bump in the middle, a raised dome in the middle of the disc. But what's even more concerning is that this thing, whatever it is, it's circling and pirouetting around the missile itself. It's moving, and these missiles travel at thousands of miles per hour. And it's keeping up right there with it, going around it. And then they see it start to fire beams of light. There are distinct beams of light coming from the object going towards directly the warhead. And there's one, and then it moves. And there's two, and then it moves. And then there's three, and then it moves. And then it's four. And on the fourth one, at that very moment, is when the missile starts tumbling down and crashes in the ocean. Now, at this point, one of the men in the gray suit says, "What happened there?" And Jacobs, I don't know if he was being facetious or if he was being honest, but he says, "It looks like we've got a UFO." And then they say, "Don't ever say that again. You will never say that again. And you're not going to tell a word about this to anybody." And again, this is all corroborated by this Major Mansman, who later was able to identify these two men as members of the CIA. Now, this in and of itself is definitely interesting. And in these sorts of cases, as always, the CIA men leave with the documented evidence of the aliens. The film is gone and lost. So not a lot of evidence, except that the Air Force was really weird about this in a really strange kind of way. You'd assume that if the story is not true, because he keeps his vow of silence for about 20 years, and I think it's 1982 that he breaks the story, finally. And you'd assume that if the story wasn't true, the Air Force could smugly say something along the lines of, you know, show us the tape, give us any more evidence or anything like this. But they don't. They claim that Jacobs was not in Big Sur because he was not enlisted at the time of this video recording.
Okay.
But the problem is, and the really scary thing about it, is that they produce documents to quote-unquote prove it. Like, they show his enlistment documents and this and that. But on the other hand, Jacobs himself has diary entries, he has letters, he has videographic evidence of himself at these launch sites, and he has his own original enlistment information and contract and papers and stuff that are all dated. He has his orders that are dated and signed and sealed for before this account, saying you're going to go to California and you're going to film missile launches. So, like, why would they go through the trouble of faking this man not being in the military when they could have just said, you're crazy? No, this didn't happen.
To me, that's a level of proof to discredit him.
Right.
And I think that's where the doctored
documents.
Yeah, come in.
To me, it's like that is more compelling than anything else. Like, that's the most compelling part of this whole thing, or at least his whole story, is that he can demonstrably prove that he was in the Air Force when they were claiming he wasn't.
Well, when was the end of the Cold War?
Theoretically, 80, it was like the 80s, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but like, was it dead set in the middle, like 85, or...
Let's Google it. Because it's like the end, like when they tore down the Berlin Wall. Yeah, exactly. Wasn't that? Okay.
Yeah. I guess theoretically.
Yeah. The wall came down in 91.
Oh, shoot.
We were wrong.
Yeah, we're a little off there.
Yeah.
Okay. So in that case.
What do you think? Give me your best.
I think there's still the extreme secrecy of the Air Force at that point in time. Because of the Cold War as well, with a little bit of hysteria, to where we don't want to have any information being leaked to the public that might cause anyone to freak out. Because when you're in the Cold War era, there's a couple other things that we didn't bring up, but McCarthyism was an intensely invasive fear-mongering campaign, essentially, against a lot of people. And when you have a population that has experienced something like that, and the Red Scare in general, a new level of heightened like belief and trust in our government and our military has to be established, so that people just don't lose their minds. But I think that could definitely have an impact of how the Air Force wanted to like stranglehold the whole incident.
So your thought is they're not lying about this and covering it up because it's aliens, it's because that they want to preserve a national sense of trust in the government and calm, which I can agree with that. I can see where that could be the case as well. That does make sense. For me, it's aliens.
It's covering up the aliens, yeah.
But that's just two kinds of people. Now, what's interesting so far is that we have three accounts, one of which is Missiles Underground, one of which is plutonium, raw plutonium being processed, and one of which is missiles in the air. Now, the plutonium being processed, who knows? It actually seems more reconnaissance than anything because nothing actually happened. But the missile was shot out of the air or beamed out of the air, and the missiles underground were disarmed. While these are aggressive moves by whatever's piloting these ships, it does seem to be defensive. It seems to have an overture of peace. Right? But that only works if you assume that this is by a neutral third party and not the Soviet Union.
Right.
If it's the Soviets doing this, it is the direct opposite of peace. However, if we're going to take it from the aliens, let's say that it seems like they're just trying to even everything out, keep everybody from firing these missiles and stuff like that.
Do we have any incidences from the USSR?
Yes, we do.
Ooh.
There are actually quite a few, and for the sake of time, we're only going to cover this really big one. Probably...
Oh, no way. Did I segue that, like, perfectly?
You actually did, yeah. It is the only one we're going to cover from the USSR, and it is disturbingly aggressive, and not aggressive to be defensive, aggressive to be aggressive. Now, this comes from October 4th, 1982, in Soviet-controlled Ukraine.
Okay.
Which was in an area which is near the town, here we go.
Oh, dear.
Of Bylokrovovich. Sure.
That for anyone, sounded really good.
Thank you.
That for, sounded great. For, I don't know how you actually pronounce it, but I'm going to go with that.
For anybody who would like to do more research or know, I'll probably put it in the show notes. That's Bylokrovice. I'm not going to say it again. Now, a massive craft is spotted above this missile launch area. And this is not massive in like a... It's the size of a football field, which is like something where I saw this meme that was like, why do Americans always describe things like in relative fields. To football fields?
Because that's what we know, David.
It is what we know. A football field for our non-American listeners is 100 yards, which also doesn't mean anything. It's 100 feet or it's 300 feet,
which also doesn't
mean
anything.
Too much. A yard is a meter, basically. A meter is 3.3 feet.
Yes.
So a football field is 91 meters. That's what we're going to say.
Okay.
That's a football field. This thing was bigger than that. This thing was 9 football fields.
Wait, what?
It is 900 meters in diameter.
In diameter. So it's
actually 10 football fields.
Yeah. Yeah.
10 football fields. In the sky.
That would black out the sky.
Good. I want it to.
Okay. That's like a cloud.
Because.
That's bigger than anything we've ever put in the air.
It's referred to as the size of a 5-story building. And this was witnessed by a high number of civilians and military personnel. But specifically, there's one witness by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Vladimir Platonov, who was a missile engineer. Now, Platonov claimed that the craft was disc shape. It was sealed with no portholes or windows and was apparently completely even and circular. So it doesn't have a dome in it or anything like that. Like we think with
it's just UFOs. Perfectly symmetrical.
Just a perfect silver disc, 10 football fields in diameter floating in the sky.
That would weigh so much.
Yeah, it would.
Even if it's not filled, if it's like filled with just air.
Yeah.
If it's just the outside that's metal.
Yeah.
It would weigh so much.
Yeah, so how's it floating in the air?
It's a weather balloon.
Well, that'd be a heck of a weather balloon, I'll tell you. Now,
it's causing its own weather patterns.
Within moments of this craft appearance, which this happens so often in cases where craft are unbelievably large. With smaller craft, you see them zoom into frame, you see them zoom out of frame, whatever. No one really knows where this came from. No one saw it pull up. No one saw it descend. No one saw it zoom.
The mothership.
Yeah, it just...
size, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
This thing was just there. One moment it wasn't, the next moment it was. And within moments of it showing up, the nuclear missiles that were stored, again, under the ground in the silos, they went, quote-unquote, haywire, which is not how you
That's
want...
That's not what you want your missiles to be doing.
...nuclear missile to do. Now, this control room had, as one would expect, a bit of complicated specialized equipment, which was used for monitoring and controlling the missiles, and, of course, was always staffed in case of firing on a moment's notice. Now, the signal lights which were there to indicate when the missiles were armed and preparing to launch, they turned on by themselves. No one entered in any information. No one turned any keys. I don't even know if there were keys to turn. And that, in and of itself, is not impossible. It's highly unlikely. But, theoretically, an order could have been sent directly from Moscow and somehow interfaced with the missiles itself. They didn't need... It's 1982... You've got that kind of technology. You don't need a human to actually be there turning the missile in that area. But if this was coming from Moscow, the men were supposed to get, as you would think, some sort of a confirmation.
Yeah.
So that they didn't try to shut it down. Well, there was no confirmation. And interestingly enough, as they tried to communicate with Moscow or with anybody else, they had nothing but radio silence. They weren't able to get anything out. They weren't able to get anything in. And so
they were just there trying to figure out what the best possible option is,
yeah,
what they should be doing.
Yeah, what they should do. And they couldn't and didn't do anything. If this was a genuine thing, these missiles could be the only line of defense against missiles that were coming in. You can't just stop them, because if you stop them, then you have no retaliation. And so they just sat there. They didn't know what to do. They couldn't talk to anybody. And they said, I guess this is the end of the world. And so they sat there and they watched the launch sequence countdown. This specific detail of when it stops counting down is not included, but I'd like to think it goes to one. And then it all shuts off and everything's back to normal. But
that's a horrible prank.
It's a very terrible thing. But what happens is this disc does not move. Unlike in other situations where the disturbance is only there for as long as the disc is, according to Plantonev, the radio channels were open.
Yeah.
And they say, Moscow, did you just order a missile strike? And Moscow says, no, we absolutely did not, my good man. What are you talking about? That alerts the Kremlin to send the KGB to go see what's going on. The KGB do get there eventually, but in the time that they're sitting there, the disc just stays there for about an hour, just hovering over the base. And according to Plantonev and the KGB reports, over 1,000 people saw this happen.
Where are the cameras?
I know. It's Soviet-controlled Ukraine.
I know.
There
Why?
Probably aren't that many cameras in Soviet-controlled Ukraine.
In that case, were the aliens just toying with them? What were they doing?
Well, we're going to get to we're going to get to what they were doing, because we have one more thing to talk about after this.
Well, okay then.
But Plantonev also talks about so that's Plantonev. There's another radio operator, a man by the name of Vladimir Mantaveviev, and he is of the 50th Missile Division. According to him, a few days after, so the KGB commission comes in.
Yeah.
They interrogate, they say what's going on, they get their information, they leave. A few days after that, an order, like a designated order, comes, and their commander in chief comes and lines up all the men of the base and reads this order that says, if you see a UFO, do not panic and do not shoot. That's the order. It's order number R010.
That's so weird. You'd think you'd use, like, you know, anti-air artillery or something to knock it down. Again, this
do
is,
you really
this
want to is... knock down 10 football fields of metal onto an unsuspecting village? Not unsuspecting, because they're all suspecting something at that point.
I mean, no, but not all UFOs are that large.
No, of course not. That'd be wild. I want to see the hypermassive UFO. I want that. I don't just want to see, like, one little ball of light over a nuclear processing committee. I want to see the 10 football field-sized UFO hovering in the sky. Oh, it sounds amazing.
Yes.
I love it. But we have one last story here, and it is a mirror of what happens there in the Ukraine. And this takes place actually, how much earlier? 16 years earlier in North Dakota. Now, on the front page,
we're hopping all over the
place. I know. And I'm just trying to show this happens all over the place. Like I said, there are dozens of accounts of Soviet interference. The majority of them are the same sort of thing, that they show up and the nukes are disarmed, or there's just UFOs flying over the base. But, like, that's the most dramatic one. And this one here, I'd say, is maybe even more dramatic. Now, on the front page of the Minot, M-I-N-O-T, I have to believe that's how that's pronounced. It's not Minot. Minot. I'm going to say Minot. And if I'm wrong, you can correct me on that one. That's fine. On the front page of the Minot Daily News in, I think it was December 6th, 1966, a headline reads, MNO Launch Control Center saucer cited as one indication of outer space visitors. The article explains that it is referencing an event which took place on August 25th of 1966, which was referred to as principal evidence of extraterrestrial visitation and interference in matters nuclear, by none other than our UFO father himself, J. Allen Hynek. Oh, Hynek, you beautiful man. I'm so glad to see ya. Glad you're back on the show. How are you, Hynek? Well, he's dead, so he can't respond. But I love him just as much as I've ever loved him before. Got anything to say to UFO Dad?
Nope.
Okay. I have to believe he's listening. Now, the article described a launch control center officer stationed underground when suddenly he realized that all of his radio communication was simply static. Which, again, mirrors what happens in the Ukraine. He's got nothing coming in, nothing going out. As he works to fix this below, very similar to other stories, up above, security personnel sees a red light high in the sky, with radar confirming the presence of something 100,000 feet up in the air. Now, this thing starts to bob and weave and ascend and move, and as it does, the radio static underground begins to clear up. And then this light dives incredibly quickly, landing somewhere in the surrounding area. And a strike team is sent out to check on this object. They have a pretty good idea of where it came down, but once they got close, the strike team again loses all of their radio contact. It's just static. And they stop about 10 miles from where they believe the landing site to be. Now, after 8 minutes, the craft rises again into the air and takes off. And at that point, the craft is recorded on radar, leaving, and all of the static is gone. The visual sightings of this craft is confirmed by multiple area civilians, including one particularly reliable police officer who claimed that it was a strange disc about 30 feet in diameter with a dome in the middle of it. He had actually seen it in the day before this. And interestingly enough, it's not high up in the sky. It's like coming down the side of a mountain. It's 10 feet off of, not a mountain, a hill. 10 feet off of the ground, and he says it's just wobbling unevenly coming down this side of a hill.
Like a hovercraft.
Kind of, yeah, exactly. It's hovering more than anything. Now, unbeknownst to the people, however, this is the official report that J. Allen Hynek received. This is the official report that was published in Project Blue Book and that people knew about and that was actually shared with people in the area because, whatever, it's fine. But unbeknownst to the people of the area, as well as J. Allen Hynek and Project Blue Book, there was another layer. There was something else happening during this UFO sighting. And it is that the nuclear missiles underground were going, again, absolutely haywire, but in a very paradoxically orderly type of way. This story, if true, is one of the bigger, like, indicators as to why Project Blue Book was a flawed program, because if people are seeing UFOs or aliens, God forbid, or anything, like, just because J. Allen Hynek comes to town doesn't mean they're necessarily going to tell him everything.
Yeah.
Like, they may still keep parts of it for themselves, especially because they think of him as a spy, kind of, as somebody working against them who might give their information to the higher-ups who might then declare them unfit for service and boot them. So, while there's no official mention of this in the newspaper article or the official Air Force report, the details come to us from a man by the name of Captain David Scher, who was stationed at MNO at the time. He claims that the light did way more than just hovered overhead. It swooped down, he claims that the light did a lot more than just hover overhead, swoop down, land, and then leave. He says the craft had more nuanced movement, and somehow, without any physical indication as to the location of the missiles underground, the craft moved over each and every one of them, stopping above them with pinpoint accuracy. He said that reports of this came from other missile flight areas as well, but he experienced it firsthand at his, where 10 missiles were stored in underground silos. Of the 10, he claimed that about 8 of them went through a process that he could only describe as a series of checks. Now, due to the sensitivity of the security around the missiles, he claimed that both inner and outer security alarms were triggered. What?
Triggered.
What's triggered mean? Was triggered. But that's not even too bizarre. I mean, these are extremely sensitive security measures. Rats could set them off, and often would. And so that in and of itself was concerning, but it's not the end of the world or anything. It happened fairly recently, or fairly commonly. However, there was something that happened that he had never before seen. Each of the missiles, for each of the missiles, which again, unbeknownst to him, because this report, he's underground, he gets from other people above ground the movement of the thing over the silos, but he doesn't actually see them moving over the silos themselves. But as it comes to hover directly above each one of them, this quote-unquote check occurs. The security alarms go off, and then suddenly, for each missile individually, a launch in progress indicator begins to flash. Now, he springs into action and he inhibits each one of these launches. Basically, the way that it works is that if you get a launch in progress indicator, you can hit the inhibit switch.
Okay.
If someone at another flight also hits an inhibit switch, it cancels out the launch. If they don't, the launch goes forward. So that way, if there's one guy who's out of the loop, it doesn't stop it. But if there are multiple people who are either out of the loop or know that this isn't supposed to happen, it stops it. Now, Scher says that because of this system, it's most likely that the missiles themselves would never have launched because this was happening elsewhere. Everyone is inhibiting everything that happened, and he has to inhibit it 8 times because this happens individually with each missile. This takes a period of minutes, basically. He's springing into action, hitting all these buttons, doing everything, and once the UFO passes out of sight, these indicators and warnings are just reset to normal. This was the only time during his time at the Minnow base that the launch in progress indicator ever showed as triggered. This is not something that they would test out. This was not they did not have missile drills. If they did, this was not something that happened. This light was only supposed to come on if it was actually happening. Now, he doesn't know if, again, specifically it was another person inhibiting it that stopped it, or if simply once the UFO left, as we saw in so many other cases, once the UFO leaves, the missiles stop freaking out and everything goes back to normal as well. But Scher and others provided this information to the superiors, who told them to never mention it to anybody, even the investigators. They said, here's what happened. There was a light in the sky, it ducked, it leaved, it ducked, it weaved, there was static, it left, that was it. Do not mention anything about the missiles. And sure enough, Dr. Hynek showed up, did his investigation, wrote his report, and wasn't told a word of what had happened underground. This is the only story where we don't have external verification. Okay. Every one of these other stories has at least one, if not quite a few other people, saying that this also happened. Okay. But I also, it doesn't necessarily mean that it didn't happen, especially because of the parallels that you have with other accounts, and especially that one that happened in the Soviet Union. Now, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of reports like this from both sides. We just don't have time to go into them all today. So instead, I'd like to end here with a quote from Inessa Korienko, who was a reporter for Life magazine, which covered the affair of the Soviet missile activation. They say, quote, "I think the UFO technology allows their pilots to launch our missiles. However, they chose not to do so. Cases such as Bilokorovovich and Mino suggest that aliens are trying to understand how these systems work and what they need to do in the event of war breaking out to stop the feuding children, us. I believe that the UFO pilots, by running the rocket's pre-launch countdown, learned how to stop it." Unquote. So, that's one idea, because if the aliens wanted to destroy us, unless they have a really, they're just really itching for that dramatic irony, they wouldn't need our things to do it. If they can travel across the stars, they don't need nuclear weapons to vaporize our planet. They can just do whatever they're doing. Probably whatever fuels their ship could destroy us. Yeah, exactly. It's Aldegon. But...
Did you do that?
But you do. You get this idea that, like, these things are happening for our good. And we're going to talk more about that in the next two episodes as well.
Oh, boy.
But, Jason, what do you make of all of this? What do you think about all of this, the first leg of our Cold War alien series journey?
So it sounds like the first thing that I get is, like, this guardian angel aspect of it.
You don't even know.
I don't. And I don't know if it's, like, if this was a different time period, say if this was, I don't know, the Dark Ages, and we're talking about disarming catapults or something, would it be divine visitation? Would it be something else that we would assume or assimilate it with?
Right.
That's like the first thing, that the only thing that really comes to mind. Otherwise, from there, it's all non-verifiable at this point in time.
It's
too much time has passed. There's no way for us to agree or disagree, but it is during the height of the USO flap. Sorry, mm-hmm. There we go. So the hysteria and the belief of UFOs is
high
mm-hmm. at this point in time. So it could be a combination of different things that are going on that are doing these experiences. It is terrifying.
It is very
scary. If these are just malfunctions that were happening at that point in time, because we are a whole lot closer to vaporization
than we
ever thought we were probably. But I don't particularly have anything else.
That's
it's again, like the secrecy surrounded by this point in time and not living it myself, I have no way to really identify or connect with these experiences.
That's fair. And the thing of it as well is that while these reports, again, they start in 1945, as long as there have been nuclear weapons being made.
Yeah, yes.
They start there.
I guess I forgot about that. So are nukes what brings aliens to the world?
It's possible. There's this idea. Remember, well, maybe you didn't say it. Did you ever see a
galactic signal that says, hey, this civilization has nuclear warfare now?
Did you ever see Star Trek First Contact?
No.
Okay. It's one of the next gen movies with Picard and the gang.
Yeah.
Picard and the gang. That's what I call them. And basically, they say that what causes the... not the Romulans, the other ones, Vulcans. The Vulcans to stop and interact with humanity for the first time is that Zef Cochran is testing his interstellar, like his warp drive, basically, very primitive, but still a warp drive, at the exact moment that these Vulcans are traveling through or around our star system, and they're able to detect the signature of a warp drive being activated. And that's the moment that I might watch Star Trek today. That's the moment when they say, okay, whoever these little monkey people are, they're ready for us. And then they come down. And it's that same idea. Now, why that happens though, why nuclear weapons are the exact thing that causes it, has its own theories. One of the more interesting ones is that when you're looking at something as significant as splitting the atom, you're affecting layers of reality other than the ones that are close at hand. Earlier in the episode, at the very start, I mentioned the ultra-terrestrials, not just the extraterrestrials.
So are you saying it comes down to something like string theory, where splitting one atom caused some sort of ripple effect that was felt by a different species?
Exactly. Different dimensions.
Okay.
And so when we look at ultra-terrestrials as opposed to extraterrestrials, these are things that share or occupy not only our planet, but our relative space in space. But they do it in a different form of being through other dimensions or something along those lines. And that when you trigger a nuclear explosion, you directly rip through whatever it is that separates us and attacks these people as well. And in that way, these aliens aren't necessarily benevolent. They're just self-sufficient. They're just trying to watch out for themselves. And if we have to save the stupid humans, we'll save the stupid humans as well. Honestly, and what we're going to talk about the next 2 weeks kind of contradict this. But honestly, if I had to pick a theory, I'd probably go with that one. Like, I know it's completely crazy. You don't have to tell me that. I understand. But
well,
there's
a lot of power in nuclear weaponry, but it just feels like, looking back at it now, it just feels so primitive.
It does, but it's this idea that it affects them that makes me think of it. I don't necessarily need to know how it does.
Preservation system.
Because if they were out to help us, they would have helped us in different ways. In my opinion, they wouldn't just be content with saying, okay, don't blow yourself up and you can keep... Sure.
Probably.
Sure. But like, even if they enslaved us, but they made us happy slaves who could live forever and all of that, like... Whatever, we could be their manual labor. They could cure all of our diseases and give us space travel, and we could go to Jupiter on our days off. That's fine.
Why would you want to go to Jupiter? It's a constant
resurrect
storm.
The dead on planet Jupiter. Ugh. Stanley Kubrick, 2001, Ugh. A Space Odyssey. thank you for the segue back. That's actually what I think. I don't necessarily know that it splits time and space and affects them, but I think that the only reason they would be directly involved is if it benefits them to stop us from killing ourselves. Elsewise, right. There's no reason why they need to. There's no reason why they need to stop it other than they're benevolent. And if they're benevolent, they wouldn't act the way that they act. That's my theory.
Okay.
So, freaking love talking about aliens. I love it so much. But really quick, as I started saying a minute ago, these started with nuclear weapons. These visitations, quote-unquote visitations, interference, it still happens to this day. There's still reports. In 2012, in September, UFOs again were reported over the Malmstrom Air Force Base, patrolling an area almost identical to that of the 1967 reports by Robert Salas. Even here in Idaho, back in 2010, so we have, do you know what the INL is?
No.
Not a lot of people do. It's a nuclear laboratory in the desert.
It sounds about right. That's where you put them.
Yeah. It stands for Idaho National Laboratory. It's got 4,000 people employed. It's a $1 billion facility, and it has working nuclear reactors and all of that. And in 2010, there was a wildfire that broke out right near the reactors, and there was a video. And here's what's interesting. I've seen this video, but I cannot find this video. And it shows brightly lit objects circling in and out of the smoke and moving around the reactors in a very erratic way. And I would link to it, but I can't find it anywhere. And like, the only way that I know that I'm not making this up is that in my print book, Haunted Idaho, it mentions it there. I can't find it anywhere. I can't even find mention of, like, you can find the wildfire and you can find UFOs in Idaho, but I cannot find mention of the UFOs in the wildfire, in the INL. Whereas when this happened 8 years ago, I was in 10th grade, and I remember hearing about it and looking it up. And so, like, I don't want to be that guy, but, like, I think the government removed it from Google. I'm going to say that. I think they did. That's me. But the point is that these sorts of interferences continue to this day. Now, we're going to leave it there. We're going to come back next week, and next week we're going to talk about people, the only people who may be even more qualified to talk about aliens than the Air Force, and that is the astronauts and NASA? Cosmonauts of the American, of America and the Soviet Union. And that's what we're going to talk about next time, is their own weird experiences. And like I said, when you say guardian angels, you literally have no idea how just on point that is. So, and we'll talk about that next week.
Okay, I'm excited for it.
Jason, you got anything else you want to say?
Let's see. Nukes, invited aliens, guardians, angels.
Just do a little
that's
sum
all
up.
I got. That's all I got. All
right, that's fair. Well, we do have a few people that we would like to thank then.
Woo.
Before we close up here. Let me look.
Thanking people, how dare we?
So we'd like to really quick thank MM Developer for leaving us a review on iTunes. They say, fun and a little spooky. Thank you. I have really been enjoying this podcast. I like the quirky antics of these guys and the stories being read and told. I just think it's a really good time with a bit of lighthearted and sort of spooky banter that occurs organically. I am glad it's not just another way too serious podcast. This is what I'm talking about. This person gets it. Thank you. Thank you for getting it, developer. The other person... And yeah, anybody writing a review, we love you. Thank you so much. If you're just rating us, we can't see that. It has to have a review for us to be able to see the name. But yeah, and even if you're only rating us one star, you're helping me grow.
Sam will hurt you.
Stronger. All right. We're up to 426 reviews.
Nice.
That's or ratings. That's pretty wild. That's pretty insane. So, and then we'd also like to thank, we got one new patron this week. Their name is Diana Harriman. Woo! Diana! Thank you so much for supporting us. As of right now, we only have four lights on, and that's okay because it's the bright light of day outside, which is also provided through your patronage. Elsewise, the sun would extinguish in the sky. So... thank you for keeping us all alive in your warmth and love. Beyond that, you can find me on Twitter at BeerLordElfbane. You can find Jason on Twitter at MightyMoint.
I'm here sometimes. It's been like 4 days.
That's okay. Twitter is toxic. It's fine to not spend a lot of time
Social media in general is toxic, yeah. But you know.
You can find us on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast or join our community. Or our Facebook page, our Facebook group. There it is.
Yeah,
remember, we are not alone, a community for the strange. And you can find us on Twitter for the show under Not Alone Pod. You can email us. So email us if you want to talk at notalonepodcast@gmail.com. If you have a paranormal story that you'd like to share with us, and I'm going to make up some legal crap, and that you are... agreeing to allow us to share on the show during a listener special or other such event, you can send that to notalonepodstories@gmail.com. We're going to keep that open all year to receive submissions. And who knows, we might start, depending on the amount of stories we get throughout the year, we may do more than one listener special a year. I think that'd be fun. Everybody usually likes them. So other than that, I definitely did it last week. I did it last week so that I didn't have to say who did it last week because I had forgotten. So I decided I would do it. So now...
what episode number is this?
Oh, man. I think it's 85?
85?
85? 84. 84. So the evens are you and the odds are me.
Bingo.
Good.
Makes it easy.
All right. All right.
You ready?
Yes.
Remember... whether you're doing safety checks on an underground silo or frantically powering off all the missiles, you are not alone.